Hi, Anne Jones here, and before we get too off track today, you know what my favourite bit of Life Matters is? The talkback. When you all get to ring in and share a bit of yourself, there's several stories over time that have stuck with me about all sorts of things, about bringing up kids. I won't go into any more, but if you're at work and you can't listen to Life Matters on the radio, there is no excuse. Look for Life Matters on the RN homepage, the ABC radio app, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You won't regret it.
The amount of iron in the ocean is like looking for a pinhead in about 200,000 Olympic-sized swimming pools. That sort of gives you an idea on the concentration range. So it's vanishingly small. Now, having said that, if you had maybe three of those pinheads, that would change the ocean from being iron-limited to being iron-sufficient. But almost one-third of the world's oceans are anemic.
Iron, one of the essential trace elements of life on Earth. Formed deep within stars, then scattered across space by collapsed supernovas which spewed their contents right across the universe. Iron is secreted in our soils, hiding in our glaciers, floating in our oceans, and carried in our blood. Hello, this is Off Track and I'm Anne Jones. Today we're on board Australia's research vessel Investigator, the CSIRO research ship. A $120 million ship of quite epic proportions. It's 94 metres long, 10 stories high, it's got weather radars on the top and scientific equipment, large and small, attached all over her hull. And chief scientist for the voyage that we're on, Associate Professor Andrew Bowie, is going to give us a rundown of iron in the ocean. And before we get started for real, all the sounds used in today's program are formed from the sounds that I recorded while I was on board the Investigator. They feature the machines and people, both scientific and maritime, that make this research possible. I've just stretched the sound's parameters a little bit. Associate Professor Andrew Bowie from the University of Tasmania is on board the RV Investigator with some of his postgraduate students. And we're moving around the ship, getting our bearings on where the equipment is.
Their PhDs are quite closely linked. Michael's trying to characterise the source of that atmospheric deposition before it enters the ocean. Bushfire, yeah. Particles, anthropogenic emissions from industry, ship's emissions.
Bowie is a marine biogeochemist who looks closely at the minute chemical makeup of the ocean. And much of his work is focused on the iron cycle.
Iron is a trace element. It's present in the oceans at very low concentrations. And iron is used in a number of different processes, both in humans, both in plants, in order to stimulate growth. But like all plants and animals on land, the plants that live in the ocean need iron. Animals that live on the plants in the ocean also need iron. They often get that from the plants. And in a nutshell, there isn't enough iron in most of the world's oceans to be sufficient for growth, for healthy growth. And, that's a sort of paradox, and that's one of the things we've been studying. And one of the reasons we're so interested in looking at iron and its role in biological growth is because the growth of marine plants in the ocean go through the process of photosynthesis. This takes carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and puts oxygen back in the atmosphere. And approximately every second breath we take as humans is supplied by the marine plants in the ocean. So it's doing humans a service, this phytoplankton growth, putting oxygen for us to breathe, but also pulling carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. And this carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is currently warming the planet. Now, if we have more understanding of the processes that change the biological growth of the Southern Ocean, and in the future whether there be more biological activity, then we'll know whether there be more carbon dioxide drawn out of the atmosphere, and get a better gauge on how Earth's climate may change in the future and how it's changed in the past. And if you went back sort of 20 or 30 years ago, the iron cycle in the ocean was quite simple. We
We thought iron was delivered by atmospheric dusts. Some fraction of that dust contains iron. Some fraction of that iron in the dust dissolves in seawater when the dust hits the ocean surface, and that is taken up by the marine plants that live in the ocean, used for their growth, and then other small animals and higher trophic levels feed on those plants and those small creatures to get their iron. And eventually the iron in those, in the biological forms, would sink to the ocean depths and be locked up in the sediments again, and at some point in geological history be recycled. And that was our simplistic understanding.
I know that that's the simple version, and you've been really at pains to say 20 years ago. That makes me think that in the last 20 years we may have made leaps forward in our understanding of how this whole process is working.
Particularly during the early 1990s, so a little, 20 plus years ago now, we've conducted colleagues of mine, and I was just at the start of my scientific career there, but we conducted a series of quite pioneering experiments looking at the role of iron in the ocean, and found some quite dramatic results, and found, almost to our astonishment, that almost one third of the world's oceans are anemic. They are limited by the amount of iron that is available, and we were quite astonished by that.
So the parts that are anemic, they don't get the large blooms of phytoplankton. It's the areas that have iron, plus a whole heap of other things, I'm imagining, that have those blooms that you can sometimes see in satellite images?
Yeah, absolutely true. Iron is only one of many elements and many nutrients that marine plants need for growth. Nitrate, phosphate, silicate, these major nutrients that are vital too. But quite a large area of the ocean have those nutrients. They're plentiful, particularly the Southern Ocean. And those regions should be productive. They should have these large phytoplankton blooms. They should be nice and red and green on the satellite images you see. But when we look from the ocean colour satellites, we see they're blue, which means they're essentially ocean deserts. And why is that? Because there's nutrients present, but we found there is very little iron. There's only a few oases of life, of strong marine phytoplankton blooms in the Southern Ocean where the iron is delivered.
But we're talking the Southern Ocean, the Antarctic Ocean, remote and isolated. If there's phytoplankton blooms that happen down in the sea there, then where is the iron from?
So Heard Island is in the Indian sector of the Southern Ocean. It's one of the remotest islands on planet Earth. In some ways, it's even more remote to Antarctica, because you can actually take a plane to Antarctica, but you cannot fly to Heard Island. So the only way to access it is from a ship. It is an active volcano. Heard Island is Australia's only active volcano. And this region around the Kerguelen Heard Island Plateau and downstream, where the waters flow after they've passed by the islands, we know is a highly productive ecosystem in the Southern Ocean. And our hypothesis was that it was the iron from the Kerguelen Plateau and from Heard Island itself that was actually stimulating this growth of marine plants in the region and causing these massive phytoplankton blooms. In early January this year, we took the RV Investigator down to Heard Island. It was the first major voyage of the Investigator. It was over 50 days long. We set off from Fremantle. It took us at least 2 weeks to get to the study area. And then we spent 4 or 5 weeks working there, intensely looking at the geology, the physics, the atmospheric chemistry, and the oceanography of the region to try and characterize the processes going on there and look at this, examine this hypothesis that iron was being delivered from these regions that stimulate the blooms, and also specifically iron from submarine volcanoes was playing a key role in this. When we arrived at Heard Island, we didn't really know what to expect. Heard Island is largely covered in cloud for almost 300 out of 365 days of the year, so looking from satellite at the island is difficult. We don't know what the volcano there is doing. When we arrived there, we had lovely clear skies. It was windy, it was cold, but it was nice and clear, and the volcano was erupting. So the volcano above Heard Island was covered in snow and glaciers and ice, and then there was this eruption coming out of the top, and then the lava was coming down the side and melting into the glaciers, and it was dramatic from day one. We then went on to map the waters around Heard and its companion McDonald Island, and found a number of submarine mounds that were, we hypothesized, to be volcanic. These waters hadn't been charted before. The ship was took it very steadily around those islands because we didn't know where there were submerged rocks. And we found that there was these submarine volcanoes. Some of them were active. They were releasing fluids or gases. We were still in the process of characterizing exactly what was in those fluids. We did manage to conduct a number of surveys around the islands to look for iron, and we found that iron was plentiful around Heard Island. We believe it was from a number of sources, not just the submarine volcanoes, but also the glaciers themselves. They were melting into the ocean. These glaciers were thick with this lava from the volcano. As I say, the lava was full of iron, so that was another source of the iron to the ocean. So we believe there was multiple pathways at play delivering that iron to the region, but we know it was an iron-rich region, and there was indeed large phytoplankton blooms happening in the regions downstream of Heard Island when we were there.
If you were a scientific superman and you were able to hover above Heard Island for a whole year, what would it look like in terms of what happens to the phytoplankton in the area over that time?
That's a good question. So as well as the iron that is central for plant growth, plants need the right temperature, they need the right light regime. Just think of your garden in spring. When it warms up a little bit, you've got longer hours, garden takes off. The Southern Ocean, or the ocean itself, all over the world, is no different. In spring, the temperature of the ocean is warming up, the light regime is getting longer, and then all these factors combined with this delivery of iron around Heard Island, with the delivery of nutrients from deeper in the ocean, they combine together to have a massive bloom, and it takes off, and you can see that very clearly. So you'd have the bloom that then generally takes place for 3 to 4 months through the spring, through the summer, and then it sort of lasts through the late summer a little bit, and then the blooms drop off as you go into autumn, just as your garden would back home. And then essentially, you know, you have very low phytoplankton production and very low biological growth through winter until the next season starts up the following spring.
On Off Track, I'm Anne Jones, and today I'm with Associate Professor Andrew Bowie from the University of Tasmania. We're on board the RV Investigator, the CSIRO's Blue Water Research Vessel, and Bowie is on board with research students setting up new apparatus which will collect environmental data about the ocean.
All systems have to be modified for use on board a ship because there's a lot of gear that works fine on land, but in the harsh environment of the moving salty atmosphere, they fail, so you have to design equipment very well.
Associate Professor Bowie studies ocean chemistry and often has a focus on the iron cycle. Iron is in the ocean in minute amounts, and it's used by tiny organisms called phytoplankton. Phytoplankton float around in the water and they photosynthesize for energy. They use the iron in the water to grow and bloom. Phytoplankton photosynthesis is sort of like the trees on land. It absorbs CO2, it produces oxygen, and when the organism dies, it falls through the layers of the water column, eventually settling into the sludge on the bottom of the ocean, and over geological time, it becomes stone, sequestering that carbon away. We've got a lot of carbon in the atmosphere right now from anthropogenic emissions. So what about the idea of fertilizing the ocean with iron? Dumping iron into the waters to encourage a bloom, to encourage carbon absorption. Is iron fertilisation the answer to climate woes?
We have studied this aspect quite a lot, going right back into the 1990s, and the first experiment to look at what the addition of iron will do to the ocean mesoscale. So, in other words, add in iron to the ocean and look at the response. This was done in 1999 by a joint New Zealand-Australian-UK consortium. We had a dramatic response. The ocean responded dramatically then. We did get this large phytoplankton bloom and large CO2 drawdown. So we demonstrated that the efficacy of this, that it does work. But we spent a lot of time more recently looking at the other aspects of that whole question, the capacity of the ocean, to how much CO2 could it possibly draw down, the risks involved with it, how you'd verify any experiment, how much carbon is drawn down, and also the legal aspects. There's, you know, the oceans are policed quite closely by the international community, and we need to be careful what is added to the ocean, and there's a number of unknowns, which mean that this notion of adding iron to the world's oceans and it will solve our problem of currently warming the planet by production of CO2 is unlikely to have that dramatic effect. There will be a role it'll play, and there's natural processes at play all over the world's ocean where the oceans are naturally fertilized with iron. But it isn't a silver bullet, as some people have suggested.
In fact, there is currently an international moratorium on iron fertilization of the ocean. And what about some of the other ocean issues that we've been hearing about? Ocean acidification, for example, does the iron cycle interface with that?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, these processes are all interlinked. Any increase in biological production in the ocean will draw CO2 out of the atmosphere. These are natural processes that have been taking place for hundreds of thousands of years. This is nothing new, but as more CO2 goes into the ocean, that will change the acidity of the ocean and will slowly make the ocean slightly more acidic. The problem is that there is more CO2 in the atmosphere now, so the ocean can take up more CO2 than it has in the past and become more acidic. But these processes have been happening naturally for a long time, and we just need to understand how this will change in the future. The balance of ocean acidification will be different compared with the surface and the deep oceans, with the addition of CO2 as it goes into the ocean. So it's a complex story.
When we're talking about it, up until now in this conversation, it sort of sounded like there must be like huge blocks of iron entering the ocean, but it's actually not like that. We're talking about fairly small amounts here, aren't we?
Right, absolutely. So you're talking minute amounts, and to give you an idea what minute may be, this is an analogy a former postdoctoral advisor gave to me, but he said the amount of iron in the ocean is like looking for a pinhead in about 200,000 Olympic-sized swimming pools. That sort of gives you an idea on the concentration range. So it's vanishingly small. Now, having said that, if you had maybe three of those pinheads, that would change the ocean from being iron-limited to being iron-sufficient. So the changes are so subtle as well. So you don't need a huge amount of iron from a major source. You don't need a ship rusting away in the ocean to provide enough iron for growth. You need a very minute amount to change the sufficiency of the ocean in terms of iron. And things like dust supply from the continents, things like melting glacier, things like sedimentary resuspension around some southern ocean islands, these can provide that small amount of iron to change the ocean from an iron-limited to an iron-sufficient condition.
Bowie's current work on board the Investigator is all about the measurement of trace elements. And we climb up to an area that's just below the bridge to inspect one of the new pieces of equipment.
This is an automated brain sampler. In the past, a lot of people have just done this by a simple bucket and funnel, and they've stood out here in the rain, getting wet and collecting rainwater, but this is an automated sampler. Morgan's just going to switch it on now. So it's got a precipitation sensor on the left-hand side here. That detects a rain event. So it typically needs about 5 drops of rainwater to pass through that rain sensor before it comes on. That will then trigger the lid, which opens and rests on that platform, and then you've got 2 sample openings there. And it's quite simple. We just collect the rain directly in these 2 individual sample bottles, and we're going to do different types of analyses on each of these sample bottles.
But wait a second. Why are all these chemical oceanographers looking at rain? Shouldn't they be sampling the ocean directly?
Australia is a large, essentially quite dry and arid continent. You get huge areas of desert, effectively, in inland Australia, and you get these large dust storms that happen, particularly during spring and summer, from central Australia. The dust is entrained, uplifted, and transported thousands of kilometres out into the ocean. We know this because we can see it by satellites, so part of our aim is to look at the effect that dust makes on the ocean when it enters the ocean. And then the trace elements, such as iron, is one of the things we're looking at. We're sampling for these dusts, for these atmospheric particles, using an aerosol sampling system, which is contained under the deck on that raised platform at the bottom there. Under there is a lab called the aerosol sampling lab. And we've got a system set up there with some pumps and flow meters and filtration units. And about 10 meters up that mast on the front of the deck there, there is a sampling inlet with a metallic nozzle, a stainless steel nozzle that sticks out. You can see it's just to the right there. It's like a sort of cone shape. That nozzle points into the wind, and it will move to port and starboard, depending on where the wind's coming from, and it's a continuous air sampling intake. It's really good. It's at the front of the ship and up high because it doesn't sample seawater. So when the ship starts taking on some seawater, that nozzle is generally above the level where the water comes on the ship. So we've got a system set up in the aerosol lab to collect the air and filter out the particles, the atmospheric particles. How do you know you're not sampling the ship?
Yeah.
There is a separate sector control switch which will turn the pumps we've got on and off depending on which direction the wind's coming from. So if the wind was coming directly behind us, we'll probably sample, the stack will be coming over the front here and it would be past that air inlet, but we turn our system off or it automatically turns itself off so we don't sample those air masses because it wouldn't really be reflective of what's naturally in the ocean.
And it's not just precipitation that they're sampling, but also the air. So let's get down to the aerosol lab, which is in a sealed off section of the ship.
Is that Bridge? Hi, it is Andy. I'm off to the aerosol lab with three others, Michael, Morgan, and Anne. All right, I'll give you a call when you get back. All right, cheers.
Just beneath the bow, where the ship is pointy at the front, there is a foil-lined room sealed with a sea-going door. There are no windows, and instead there are humming and clicking machines in stacks. It's claustrophobic in there, and without a horizon to look at, the bouncing and rolling and movement of the ship on the waves is intense. The room is immediately below the tall mast at the front of the ship that the professor's already mentioned.
The bottom of that air, that mast, and there's multiple sample lines coming off, which go to various instruments in here and in the air chemistry laboratory. Just an example, this is a cloud condensation nuclei monitor. It actually does some chemistry.
Using this clean air sampling system, the scientists will assess the trace elements in the air, like iron, tiny, tiny amounts of minerals that are entering the ocean but could have a major effect.
So how do you measure such minute amounts?
With difficulty. It's not an easy task. The first thing is you've got to work extremely cleanly. Iron is everywhere. It's on a human skin, it's in the dust. We're on a ship right now, made of metal, largely made of components included iron. The ship's out on a very salty ocean. Like anything with salt around, they generally corrode a little bit. So there's iron contamination everywhere. So the first thing is we need to work extremely cleanly. We need to use equipment and an apparatus that has been thoroughly prepared, acid washed in a manner that can eliminate any chance of contamination. And we need to work in a clean air environment where the air is filtered. We are in clean suits when we're working in there, so the risk of contamination from us to the samples is very low. So this is a relatively short transit from Hobart to Sydney. We have one of the primary focus of this voyage is to establish some equipment for measuring the amount of atmospheric deposition that comes from the land into the ocean. That deposition can be either in a dry form, such as dust, such as bushfire emissions, anthropogenic emissions from industry, even ships emissions, but also can be in a wet form in terms of precipitation, rain. So we have a couple of new pieces of equipment on board. We have an aerosol sampling system which collects air from a mast 10 meters high on the very front of the boat. This air is then passed through very clean tubing into a filtration unit, and we collect the particles onto filters. We generally have to sample for about 24 hours to get enough of those particles from the atmosphere on those filters, and then we're going to go away and do some experiments on board the vessel and then some analyses back in the lab to look at the contents of these particles that are in the atmosphere. So when we're back on land, because we need to work cleanly, and there's the pumps coming on now, so the wind must have started coming from the forward quarter, I think, actually, and you feel that roll of the ship, well, that means we've just turned a corner. So we're probably coming around Tasman Island or getting close to Tasman Island. We turned a corner and the wind's obviously come into the forward quarter, so the pumps have started. So when we're on land, we're actually working clean. So
iron is delivered in many different forms up to the ocean and from many different sources. In the Australian region, the deposition of atmospheric dust and bushfires is one of the primary forms, particularly in spring and summer, when dust is entrained through massive dust storms and the bushfire seasons happen. And bushfire smoke is transported up and away into the ocean. We haven't really been able to constrain that very well, but we're now starting up a series of transects around Australia, utilising the Investigator, to be able to look at the atmospheric deposition of trace elements into the ocean, and in the future, the effect on marine ecosystems. And even though this is a short voyage, the equipment will carry on the next voyage, which will go from Sydney to Brisbane, and look at the dust corridor, which happens off the eastern seaboard through spring and summer. Major dust storms do happen. And next year, we will continue the project further and go right round to Broome at the top end and look at that quarter. And eventually, in Western Australia, we look at the atmospheric deposition from WA.
I'm finding it hard to reconcile the fact that we can have such rich terrestrial iron environments and it be so dilute in the ocean, because there must be a lot of iron entering the ocean. There has to be, surely.
Well, this is partly the problem, in that the iron and the land in the desert regions, it doesn't get transported to the oceans that much, or what is transported isn't transported to a part of the world's oceans where it's needed, or the iron is not necessarily in the form that the plants that live in the ocean need. They need a very soluble, they need a bioavailable form. And that iron in the dust, from the Australian outback, isn't necessarily in the form they need.
No, I think that it's probably important to point out about your work that you don't just focus on iron. You're looking at a whole heap of trace elements.
Yes, that's correct. So what we really look at is most of the micronutrient trace elements. And what I mean from that, I mean elements such as copper, such as cobalt, such as nickel, such as manganese. All these elements are essential for growth, and they're all needed in different concentrations, different ratios to each other. So when we make our measurements in the ocean, where we make our measurements of the dust deposited into the ocean, we don't only look at iron, we look at all these elements together, because they will have a subtle effect on the functioning of the ocean.
Do you still feel like we've still got a ways to go before we understand the ocean?
Absolutely. For one reason alone, there's large parts of the oceans which we haven't really studied in any real detail.
Associate Professor Andrew Bowie is with the University of Tasmania, and this program was recorded while I was on board the CSIRO research vessel Investigator. Remember to keep an eye out on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter for me, Anne Jones, and the ABC website as well for photos of what it's really like to be on board a research vessel. I'm Anne Jones and this is Off Track. Remember to meet me here at the same place next time, because that's when I'll take you somewhere else.